when I was in a state of mania, I never thought there was anything wrong with me at all. It was just the opposite. I felt wonderful, felt high. My brain was working so fast. The only time I began to feel there was something wrong was when I was in depression. And I did go see the doctors and they said, you're fine, but they were wrong. My behavior started to get more and more bizarre in terms of grandiosity, religiosity, speaking faster and faster, more out of control, more risk-taking, poor decision-making without consulting with anybody, less and less personal discipline because the mania just made me so confident. And so what was happening is that mania was going up, up, up over a period of 12 years. So from 2003 in Iraq till 2014, when it blew up into full-blown mania, I was essentially fired, forced to retire, and then later hospitalized. My behavior started getting more and more bizarre.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guest today is retired Major General Greg F. Martin to talk candidly about his struggle with undiagnosed bipolar disorder. Energetic, devout, studious, and intensely focused, General Martin was considered an ideal officer and leader and quickly rose up the ranks of the U.S. military. But the pressure of organizing dozens of life and death missions during the Iraqi War started to alter the biochemistry of his brain and caused him to develop late onset bipolar disorder, a condition that sent him whipsawing between grandiose ideas that he was a kind of Superman who held the key to world peace to suicidal depressions. His erratic behavior eventually forced his resignation as president of the National Defense University and ended his military career. General Martin is with us today to talk about his brave and candid new book, Bipolar General, My Forever War with Mental Illness, and his very personal struggle with this undiagnosed mental condition and how finding the right treatment saved his life. It's my great honor to welcome retired Major General Greg F. Martin as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the military?
Sure. First, it's great to be on. Thanks so much for doing this show. So I was born in Holbrook, Massachusetts, near Boston, grew up there, had tremendous energy, enthusiasm, drive. I was kind of the all-star kid in high school, captain of the teams, honor roll, leadership, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had kind of a military family where my dad was in the Navy. All my uncles were in some military service. So I had always wanted to serve in the military at some point in my life. Didn't know what service, didn't know what I wanted to do, but just wanted to do something. Mm-hmm. And then when it was time to go to college, I found out about the service academies and I said, wow, here's a chance to not only go to college, but then be commissioned as an officer in, whichever service it was. And I thought it was a really fantastic opportunity. So I got accepted to and went to West Point. Mm-hmm. And then, gladly paid back my 5-year service obligation in the Army, which was a blast. I mean, it was exciting, dangerous, traveled, wonderful people, lots of challenges, big mission during the Cold War. And so that's what really brought me into the Army.
Your book is about the disease of bipolar. And when you tell your story, it started to exhibit itself early in your life. When you were in high school, you sort of had an obsession with basketball.
Yeah.
Like you seemed to be the guy who would work harder, who would put in more time, who would practice harder than anybody else. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I didn't know it at the time, but I found out, while I was writing the book and did a lot of research and talked to lots of doctors, that I actually had a condition called hyperthymia.
Mm-hmm.
And hyperthymia is not a mental illness. It's really an advantage if you have it. But what it is your brain produces and distributes lots and lots of extra dopamine, endorphins, and other powerful chemicals. So essentially, with hyperthymia, you're living in a near continuous state of mild mania.
Mm-hmm.
And because of those chemicals flooding into the brain, it drives up a person's enthusiasm, energy, drive, creativity, problem-solving skills. And so that happened to me, you know, in abundance.
Yeah.
And the only bad thing about hyperthymia is that oftentimes, about half the time, it leads to bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, there's a thing called the bipolar spectrum, which starts low, like when I was a teenager. And I slowly worked my way up the bipolar spectrum for years and decades, where living with this bipolar brain helped me, it enhanced me, it made me a better performer.
Yeah.
Until I was in my 40s and it went too high and then it hurt me.
Yeah, it sounds like it was almost like a superpower early in your life, early in your career. Like every assignment that you had, you succeeded at. You seemed to be like this extremely positive person, very outgoing, well-liked, and very effective. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And you chose to go into the Corps of Engineers. Can you talk about that decision and what that led to?
Sure. So in those days at West Point, everybody took pretty much the same curriculum, which was really heavy in math, science, engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I did really well. I graduated, you know, close to the top of my class. From the beginning of West Point until fairly recently, the number one branch in terms of popularity and desirability was the Corps of Engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a bunch of professors, instructors who were engineer officers, and they told what it was like being an engineer, and it sounded really great. Very diverse assignments, lots of different types of engineer units, you know, from combat engineers to construction to bridging,
mm-hmm.
Et cetera. And so I looked at it and said, wow, this looks really good. And my service commitment was 5 years. And so I thought about it and said, well, if the other branch that I was strongly considering was the infantry, which is, you know, great branch, really the heart and soul of the Army. And I said, well, if I'm only going to serve 5 years and then I'm going to get out and be a civilian, am I better off being an infantry officer getting out of the Army after 5 years, or am I better off being an engineer officer? And I mean, that's a pretty easy answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, you know, for all these reasons, I chose Corps of Engineers. And it was a great choice. I mean, I served in a wide variety of different units, different missions, different assignments. It was very, very challenging. The soldiers, the combat engineers, were fantastic soldiers to lead. I mean, they were really, you know, tough guys. They lived hard. They partied hard. They did everything. They were good in the field. And so it was really a great choice for me.
You know, most people, maybe they've heard of the Corps of Engineers, but they're not really familiar with what they do and how key their role is in combat and not in combat. Can you talk about a few of the assignments you had and a few of the things that you led in Corps of Engineers?
Sure. The bulk of the people in what they call the engineer regiment, which is like the overall Corps of Engineers, most of the troops are combat engineers,
mm-hmm.
who essentially fight in the close combined arms fight, you know, hand in hand with armor or tanks, infantry, and artillery. And so what the combat engineers do is, like when I was a platoon leader during the Cold War, we fought alongside armor, infantry, artillery, and we put in anti-tank obstacles. So big ditches in the ground,
mm-hmm.
minefields were put in, fighting positions so that the tanks and the infantry fighting vehicles and the artillery could kind of go down and be in a protected little hole, really, a hole that they could go in and they're protected. So that's mainly what we did. But meantime, I was also in units that did bridging. Assault float bridging or pontoon bridges, which were critical in the attack to Baghdad those bridges, the Army, the U.S. military forces, without those bridges, would have had a very, very difficult, slow time with a lot more casualties getting to Baghdad, were it not for the engineers putting in the ditches. Also on the battlefield, we opened up damaged runways, built helipads, built airstrips in the desert. We cleared routes of mines in improvised explosive devices. We built berms, protective berms for headquarters, command and control centers, signal centers, Patriot missile sites, logistics sites, because what you needed to do was to protect them against direct small arms fire and explosions coming in from missiles and stuff. So we did that. The other thing the engineers do is they maintain, and it's done by mostly a civilian workforce, they maintain the infrastructure that the Army owns. Mm. So they build new construction facilities for the Army. They maintain the buildings and the grounds for all these big Army bases. And then the third big thing the engineers do is there's a thing called it's a little redundant, but they call it the Army Corps of Engineers. And it's all civilians, 35,000. They're spread out all over the country. And they do major construction, over a couple million dollars for both the Army and the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And then they do the civil works program for the country, meaning they dredge harbors and rivers for navigability. They run electric power plants the power is generated by moving rivers. They do environmental remediation and cleanup to ensure that, the Endangered Species Act is followed. They also do disaster relief and recovery. The Corps was the big force, after Hurricane Katrina and other big natural disasters. So that's another side of the Corps. And I've served in all of them. And then the one I forgot is what they call topographic or geospatial engineering, which is pretty high tech. And you use satellites to come up with imaging of the Earth's surface. Mm. And then you can use that to plan military operations, to give, intelligence and knowledge to the battlefield commanders so they understand what the terrain and the land is like. So you can see it's a pretty diverse mission set.
Yeah, absolutely. So it seems as though your career was just sort of clearing one hurdle after another, one success after another, leading up to Iraq. And when you got to Iraq, your role was key. You were assigned to 5th Corps, correct?
Yes.
And you were on the ground leading the way towards the attack on Baghdad. As you just pointed out, roads had to be cleared, pontoon bridges had to be put up.
Yes. I was super fortunate that as a colonel, I got chosen to command the 130th Engineer Brigade, which was the organic engineer brigade for U.S. 5th Corps, which was commanded by a 3-star general, General Wallace. So we trained really, really hard in Germany, and we prepared, and we did all the administrative and the medical stuff and all the preparation. And then we shipped all our equipment and the soldiers to Kuwait. And then we trained more in Kuwait, and we really refined our procedures and our tactics to a knife's edge. And so the engineers, basically, the first big mission that we did was to cut through the border obstacle system on the Kuwait-Iraq border. Mm-hmm. So there were big, big tank ditches that stretched along the entire border between Kuwait and Iraq. So we had to cut lanes through that. And then we had to fill in the tank ditches. And we had to do all this, proofing for mines, because we didn't know whether the area had been mined or not. And we had to reduce everything on the Kuwaiti side as well. And so we did all that prior to the actual invasion. So we were out in front, the first troops actually inside of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And then what happened is the infantry and the armor and the artillery then, used those lanes and, rough combat roads we built. And they use those as their attack lanes into Iraq. And then we moved up the road and the infantry had seized a big airbase. But it was covered with mounds of dirt, broken down tanks, trucks. So what they did is they littered the airfield with stuff, including explosive hazards, so that we couldn't use it to land U.S. Air Force planes. And so we had to clear all that and get it open. We thought we needed 12 hours. It took 6 hours to get it open.
Wow.
And then airplanes started flying in from the Air Force.
Yeah.
And then we went to the Highway 1 bridge on the Euphrates River, and we captured the Highway 1 bridge and secured it as a river crossing site along the Euphrates. And then we ended up having, unexpectedly, because of enemy attacks out of the Shiite cities, we had to go into the desert and build a 95-kilometer road with no planning, nothing. We didn't have the materials, the equipment, or anything. But what we did innovatively, we went into, with translators, we went into all these Iraqi cities and towns, and we found construction contractors who had heavy construction equipment, gravel stockpiles, Portland cement, and we basically paid them with cash.
Yeah.
And they were a huge help. They probably built 30 to 50% of the road, and then the rest was built by U.S. Army engineers.
Mm-hmm.
But that then became the main route to go from the southern city of Asamoah, and we paralleled Euphrates River to go all the way to Najaf. It was really an unbelievable project.
Wow.
That could carry two-way traffic, tanks, artillery, heavy supply trucks, and the like. Then we got up to, and then we had to keep the routes open, you know, continuously, because all that traffic would really tear the roads apart.
Sure.
And then we got up to close to Najaf, and, you know, it was an enemy stronghold. And we built a C-130 airstrip in the desert. We built an entire big supply base, helicopter landing pads and all that stuff. And so we did that kind of in record time. And then we launched the attack again. And then the attack to Baghdad went so well that a lot of the stuff that we built, we didn't really even need to use because we were in Baghdad very, very rapidly. But we put in the assault float bridges, put in other fixed bridges. And, you know, the engineers also fought as infantry alongside the 3rd Infantry Division, the 101st Airborne Division, the 82nd Airborne Division. And then the next big mission was we got to Baghdad, the international airport, and it was just full of, you know, broken down, half destroyed airplanes, vehicles, all kinds of stuff, dead bodies. There was a huge battle there.
Wow.
I mean, littered with, you know, bodies.
Yeah.
And cluster bombs that the Air Force had dropped and that the artillery had shot in. So we basically got the mission to clear that entire airport and get it open for, you know, aircraft. And so we did that. That took about a week, 10 days, pretty tough mission. And then once the regime fell, we then moved into the cities. And there were big problems with lack of water, lack of electricity, unexploded ordnance, heaps and heaps of garbage and trash. And at about the same time, Iranian fighters were flowing into Iraq because we didn't have enough troops to secure the borders. But we just started doing what we called Task Force Neighborhood, where we would go into these really nasty parts of the city, like Sadr City, and talk to their leaders and say, hey, what can we do to help you guys?
Yeah.
You know, what do you need? And it was, you know, clean up the trash. It was raw sewage in the streets, you know, fix the sewage system, get water flowing again, get electricity running again, you know, pick up the explosive hazards, you know, the unexploded bombs and artillery shells and all that. And so we did that for quite a while, and we continued doing missions like that for the rest of the year in Iraq. And then we decided the U.S. government made a decision that we would stay in Iraq and occupy the country.
As preparations were being made for Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, the 130th Engineer Brigade, commanded by then Colonel Greg F. Martin, was placed in charge of the largest engineering force in the theater. This included 7 different engineering battalions, as well as several company-sized elements. Their mission was to provide engineering support for the 3rd Infantry Division, 82nd Airborne Division, and 101st Airborne Division as they crossed the border into Iraq and attacked the capital of Baghdad. After the surrender of the Iraqi military, the 130th Engineer Brigade was completely repurposed. Though originally tasked with demolishing obstacles, building fortifications, and bridging operations, its role shifted to building infrastructure. The engineers engaged in a large number of initial reconstruction projects on basic utilities, including schools, water treatment plants, waste removal, and the nation's power grid.
So then we had to build base camps, living facilities with both heat capability for the winter because it's cold there, and then we needed air conditioning in the summer because it would get up to 120 degrees.
Yeah.
And so then we started building air base camps and living facilities for, you know, what grew to be about 180,000 U.S. troops.
Wow.
And then the IED, that became the biggest killer on the battlefield, improvised explosive device. So then the engineers had the prime responsibility for clearing and disabling and neutralizing the IEDs. So the engineers did most of the IED clearance, and then the EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, they would come in for the really big, complicated, super dangerous ones, because they had a lot more training on bomb disposal than the engineers. Uh-huh. So anyway, those are you know, some of the main missions that we did.
Wow, well, that's incredible. I don't think the American people appreciate what the engineers did. A remarkable endeavor, clearing roads, clearing airports, taking care of safe water and garbage collection. And so you must have been going constantly.
Yeah, pretty much nonstop. And again, you know, I was the VA and the Army Medical Department both investigated independently. How did General Martin come down with bipolar disorder? And they both independently came to the conclusion that it was the stress, the pressure, the thrill, the euphoria of combat that it triggered my genetic predisposition.
Yeah.
So I distinctly remember when we attacked from Kuwait into Iraq, I felt like Superman, mm-hmm. felt bulletproof, fearless, mm-hmm. had unbelievable energy.
Which is what you want in a warrior, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that whole year, I was in a state of mania, probably for about 98% of the year, mm-hmm. which really helped me.
Yeah. And what was that like? It sounds like you were sleeping just a few hours a day. In addition to all the work you had to do, you were doing extra PT. You just seemed to be like, you know, Superman.
Well, I felt like Superman. Mm-hmm. I was incredibly happy, euphoric, just overflowing with energy, enthusiasm. I moved and traveled, you know, all over the battlefield, you know, really, you know, pretty much fearless. And my problem solving abilities were just unbelievable. Like, I could identify and then solve very rapidly incredibly complex problems before anybody else knew there was even a problem to be solved.
Wow.
And a lot of this was done under fire.
Yeah.
And where I was making life and death decisions, you know, routinely,
yeah.
that, you know, people depended on the right judgment. And so I felt wonderful.
And you must have been a great inspiration to the men and women you were leading, I would imagine. To have a leader like that, you know, you feel like.
Yes. I mean, you said it well. And from, you know, the feedback I've received in writing the book, where I went back and talked to everybody I could talk to that I had ever served with, from lieutenant to two-star, people in Iraq said, yeah, I'm inspirational, you know, really lifted the spirits of everybody. And so the mania, for the most part, really did me, it was a huge benefit.
Then there was a political decision that was made in Iraq that affected the whole turn of the war. It's a key moment. It's probably not talked about enough. But when we took over the country, when we were able to get rid of Saddam Hussein and dominate his army, there were two decisions made. And they were made by Paul Bremer, who was the provisional coalition leader in Iraq, a civilian, I'm familiar with it because I have a friend who was sort of a CIA adjunct to Paul Bremer. He's a Lebanese American. And so he was with, I think it was General Sanchez.
Right.
And they were meeting with leaders of the Republican Guard. And basically the leaders of the Republican Guard were defeated at this point. But they were saying, hey, look, we're patriotic Iraqis. Saddam Hussein is gone. The Americans are now in charge of the country. We're here. We're organized. How can we help, basically? And according to my friend, you can jump in at any time, the decision was made in, I think it was late April, no, we want to disband the Iraqi army instead of using these people. And they were willing to pick up garbage, to act as policemen, to do whatever we needed them to do. All they wanted to do is be paid, basically. And against the recommendation of General Sanchez and CIA and other people, the decision was made to go ahead and disband the Iraqi army.
Yeah, you captured it very, very well. So the Iraqi army, there was a certain percent of the army that were fanatically loyal to Saddam Hussein. And the plan was to sort of identify, screen them out, and not let them serve in the army. But most of the Iraqi army were, as you said, I mean, they were just like regular guys
yeah.
who were patriotic Iraqis who didn't want to see their country fall apart. They were anti-Al-Qaeda. They were against the terrorists. They were anti-Iran, so they didn't like the Iranians' threats to their country. And so it was very interesting. There was an earlier decision before the war where the Secretary of Defense limited highly the number of troops that he was willing to deploy into the war.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big debate about it, and a number of the four-star generals in the Pentagon told the secretary, hey, you're making a big mistake. We can take down the regime with, you know, 100,000, 150,000 troops. Yes, we can do that.
Yeah.
But Iraq's a very big country, and once the regime falls, you have to secure the country. You have to give security in the cities. You have to secure the borders. Otherwise, foreign fighters, terrorists, Iranians are going to come flowing into the country to fight us and to try to kill Americans and undermine what we've done.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, you know, he decided to do it his way.
Yeah.
And so we had way too few troops to carry out the holistic plan of securing the country after the invasion. So what did we do? So the army said, all right, well, we'll come up with an alternative plan. When we conquer the country, before we even go in, let's get a hold of all these soldiers and army units and tell them, look, we have nothing against you guys personally.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to evict Saddam Hussein. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so if you agree not to fight us and just take your rifle and go home, we'll get a hold of you guys after Saddam is gone, and we'll put you back to work doing, you know, border security, city security, police work, cleanup work,
mm-hmm.
secure all these stockpiles of ammunition and bombs and everything. And so that was a plan. That's what we planned to do.
That was a plan that was in place.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to do it
mm-hmm.
when Mr. Bremer decided, no, I'm going to disband the Iraqi army.
Wow.
And he thought that the Iraqi army was too beaten, too disorganized, too shattered. That what he says is there was nothing to put back together. But I would disagree strongly because we were already doing it
yeah.
and carrying out our plan.
Yeah.
And these Iraqi soldiers were coming to places we told them, hey, come to this location.
Yeah.
Bring your rifle and we'll put you to work, create a new unit. Give you your missions, we'll pay you a fair wage. So these soldiers were infuriated when we broke the deal.
Yeah.
And most of them became insurgents.
Yes.
So they knew their country very well because they lived there. They were trained soldiers. They had weapons. They knew where all the ammo dumps were with all the bombs and the artillery and all the stuff to make IEDs with. And then what they did is they eventually linked up with Al-Qaeda, who came into the country,
mm-hmm.
Or the Iranians who came into the country, or other foreign fighters, and they became the main part of the insurgent rebellion and uprising against the Americans.
Yeah.
So it was a terrible decision, and it ended up getting a whole, you know, a whole lot of Americans killed and wounded.
Yeah.
Because what they started doing is, because they couldn't take us on like force to force, they started doing ambushes, suicide attacks, putting IEDs in the roads everywhere.
Yeah.
And it became a totally different kind of war, where we were fighting a savage insurgency and a counter-terror effort. And it was just awful.
Yeah. This is exactly what my friend reported. He basically said that, you know, Saddam Hussein, whatever you think of him, and he certainly had his faults, but he was very clever in that he knew his country. And even within the Republican Guard, he would form units with internal esprit de corps. And the units would be made up of Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. And that once the decision was made to disband the army, all of this fell apart. And the idea that we could run a country the size of Iraq on our own without help from the Iraqi people was just an incredible miscalculation.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that went hand in hand with that was he did a deep debathification of the Iraqi society, where he went in, anybody who had ever been a member of the Ba'ath Party was ineligible for work. Well, pretty much everybody in Iraq, in order to get a job, whether it was a police officer, a construction worker, a nurse, whatever, you had to join the Ba'ath Party and swear allegiance.
Yeah.
And so he basically disbanded all those people from future employment. And then they, too, became huge supporters of the insurgency.
So for somebody like yourself, who was so dedicated and obviously had a lot of connection to the men and women you were leading, this must have been something, this seemed to be, based on your book, that really stuck in your craw and troubled you as you're continuing to carry out the mission in Iraq.
Absolutely. It infuriated me that, you know, twice we didn't get enough troops to begin with. And then these decisions by Mr. Bremer, you know, they sabotaged what had been a brilliant military campaign to, you know, get to Baghdad, dislodge the regime, and start. We had the chance to do something really great in that country.
Yeah.
But our own political leaders sabotaged it. And you know, I don't think they did it on purpose, but I think it was hubris,
yeah,
lack of knowledge, and arrogance that caused them to do these things.
And it seemed to be a decision that was made off the cuff, which was so key to the whole effort. Now, how much of that experience, I can just imagine, would be, as a leader of men, would be so troubling and infuriating. How much of that do you think contributed to driving sort of the manic part of your personality?
I think those decisions and the resulting deaths and casualties drove me into a rage, a frustration. And that was like pouring gasoline on a fire of mania. Mm-hmm. So my mania surged higher and higher during that year in Iraq. And I was agitated, angry, full of rage, bitter, that our own government, I thought, had undercut what had been a fantastic military campaign. And so it made my mania and my bipolar disorder significantly worse.
Mm-hmm. When you came back to the United States, it seemed as though your career sort of took a little bit of a different track into a more academic area. You know, previously you had earned a PhD at MIT. So you weren't just a ground general. You were somebody who also were very strategic.
Yeah. So when we came back from Iraq, we went back to Germany, which was our home base. And I fell into a very lengthy, severe depression that I went to see the doctor a couple times. And they said, yo, you're fine. But I wasn't. It was actually the first big up-down bipolar cycle. Then I served on a very high-level four-star headquarters as the deputy for operations and planning. And that actually helped me get promoted to one star.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went back to the States and was in one of those big Corps of Engineer divisions in charge of all the construction and civil works I talked about. And then I really went into an academic track for the most part. And so these school educational training institutions are very, very complex organizations.
Yeah.
It's much simpler to lead troops on the ground, on the battlefield. It's intellectually much simpler.
Mm-hmm.
The school places are, I mean, there's civilian bureaucrats. There's, you know, Department of the Army civilians, DOD civilians. There's, you know, professor types, there's military people all mixed in. And, you know, when you come in with a mandate to change, which I got like four different jobs in a row, I was told by the four stars, Greg, go in there and transform the organization.
Yeah.
It's become too slow. It's too stodgy. It's still thinking like it's in the Cold War as opposed to these current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Get in there, shake it up, make a difference. And then I'm going to help you do better and faster by cutting your budget and cutting your manpower. Mm-hmm. And that'll make you move faster. And so I got those jobs, like four of them in a row.
Yeah.
And the reason they picked me for that is they looked at me and they said, okay, we know Greg Martin. And these are like the big four stars, like, you know, General Dempsey and Odierno and Austin and Petraeus and guys like that.
Yeah.
They say, okay, we know this guy. He was a really terrific, successful battlefield commander. You know, I saw him in action. He's really, really good. But these schoolhouse institutions really need to be reformed.
Yeah.
Who better to do it than a guy who's got a PhD from MIT? I mean, they looked at me and said, here's a guy who's, you know, really smart, very creative, very innovative, plus has all the leadership ability. And so they said, you know, your PhD makes you the single best guy in the Army to run the engineer school, Fort Leonard Wood, the Army War College, the National Defense University.
Yeah.
So I think those were the factors that led to me being picked for all those, you know, kind of academic jobs.
In July 2010, when General Martin took command of the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, his commander, four-star General Martin Dempsey, said, and I quote, "I know General Martin well. He has phenomenal intellect, energy, and creativity. Don't be surprised to see him rappelling down the side of Root Hall, which is the academic building, while quoting Clausewitz." He meant it as a compliment and a joke, but without realizing it, General Martin's boss was pointing out his yet undiagnosed manic behavior. 2 years later, General Martin was named president of the National Defense University. Another friend and colleague, General Bob Martin, said in a speech, and I quote, "Greg Martin is a veritable hurricane, a force of nature. Someone please call NDU and tell them to post hurricane warnings." These friends and colleagues identified the symptoms of bipolar disease, as many others did, but they didn't understand what General Martin was dealing with inside. And as you pointed out, actually, my father went to he was in the State Department. He went to the National War College in Fort McCain, and I remember going there. It's a beautiful spot and a great institution. But I can imagine the challenges for somebody like yourself were considerable, because academia is a whole different thing than leading a battle, you know, clearing roads to go to Baghdad. I can imagine the frustrations were endemic, and it seemed to just sort of fuel your manic side.
Yes, it absolutely fueled my mania. You know, the basic situation was these institutions and schools and the people had been doing things their way for a long time, and they didn't want to change at all, regardless of what the four-star generals, like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or the chief of staff of the Army or whoever, regardless of what that four-star wanted, their attitude was, look, we were here before you were, we're going to be here after you're gone. And, you know, it's almost like, try me.
Yeah.
See how much you can get me to change.
I'm an unmovable object.
Right. Yeah. And they would always do it in a very clever, disguised, discreet way so that they wouldn't get in trouble.
Yeah.
Or it would be obvious that they were resisting. But they did it continuously. And they didn't see the need to change, even when you would explain it or when the four-star would explain it. And so what was happening with me was I was getting frustrated because we had soldiers getting killed and maimed in the battles.
Yeah.
And if we had changed the way we were doing things in the schools, we could have saved a lot of those lives. We could have been smarter, more innovative, more adaptive, more clever. We would have figured out smarter ways to use technology, civilian capabilities, other forces. Like, you know, the Navy ended up giving a lot of electronic warfare support to the Army in the IED fight and so on like that. And I'm not saying that we didn't change at all. We did.
Yeah.
We did adapt. But it, for me, it wasn't fast enough because people were getting killed. Plus, I was getting funeral duty on a routine basis where I had to go preside over the funerals of soldiers in their hometown who had been killed in the war.
Yeah.
And that's like getting a gut punch to go do that. And so this resistance and friction from my own workforce was literally like putting, you know, rocket fuel on my mania and my bipolar disorder. And it just shot me up rapidly, much higher.
Mm-hmm. What were the manifestations of that? Were you aware that this was happening to you? And it seemed that the people closest to you, your wife, your sons, they're starting to notice it. But as you said, all the doctors that you would consult and so on, they would say, you know, no, you're fine.
So the answer is I never, when I was in a state of mania, I never thought there was anything wrong with me at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the opposite. I felt wonderful. I felt high. My brain was working so fast. And so the only time I began to feel there was something wrong was when I was in depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I did go see the doctors a total of three times when I was in depression. And they said, you know, you're fine, but they were wrong. But my behavior started to get more and more bizarre in terms of grandiosity, religiosity, speaking faster and faster, more out of control, more risk-taking, poor decision-making without consulting with anybody, you know, less and less personal discipline because the mania just made me so confident. And so what was happening is that level, that mania was going up, up, up over a period of 12 years. So from 2003 in Iraq till 2012 or 2014, when it blew up into full-blown mania and I was essentially fired, forced to retire, and then later hospitalized, my behavior started getting more and more bizarre. Nobody really noticed anything because it was incremental changes.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like a big, crazy blow-up. It would be like kind of a bizarre event. And then nothing would happen for a while. Then maybe another bizarre event, and then nothing for a while. So none of the people I worked with, really not even my wife, thought there was a pattern of any kind of really bizarre bipolar behavior until 2014, when I went into full-blown mania, where I essentially went into a state of madness, insanity, thought I was the smartest guy in the world, held the key to world peace. You know, saw the Holy Spirit descend, thought I could fly, didn't sleep for 3 months.
Wow.
And I was talking faster and faster. I would go, sometimes talk for hours at a time, never ending ideas. I'd miss meetings. I'd forget them. I'd go to work without my uniform on. I thought I could fly. I saw a pack of demons fly at our house and I repelled them using, Bibles and crosses and holy water.
Mm-hmm.
So by that time I was in a state of insanity, and then everybody noticed, my wife, my son, my faculty, staff, students, and they started writing, anonymous letters to my boss, the chairman, saying, hey, this guy is lost it. He's crazy.
Yeah.
Which I was.
Yeah.
And then General Dempsey did the assessment, the investigation, and decided to pull me out of the job at National Defense University. And, you know, that's quite a story. He called me in and said, he gave me a big hug and said, "Greg, I love you like a brother. Hmm. You've done an amazing job at National Defense University. I give you an A+, but your time is over.
Yeah.
You have until 5 p.m. to resign or I'm going to fire you. And I'm giving you an order to get a psychiatric health exam."
Mm-hmm. And you took that in a positive way. You weren't devastated. You were still in this manic state, correct?
Yes. In fact, when he told me that, I said, "Thank you, General Dempsey," gave him a hug and said, "God put me in this job to do big things, and now he's going to put me somewhere else to do even bigger things. Thank you." And, you know, it's interesting. 9 years later, I think what I'm doing now in terms of my mental health bipolar mission is really probably more important than the Army.
Yeah.
But then I went and got 3 evaluations from the psychiatrist, and 3 times they misdiagnosed and said, "Fit for duty, nothing wrong." But they were completely wrong. I was very, very sick. My brain was awful.
Yeah.
And then I spiraled into I spiraled into anger, rage, bitterness. And then I went into terrible, hopeless, crippling depression, terrifying psychosis. And then I knew, okay, there's something really wrong. I went back to the doctor myself and said, "Doc, there's something wrong with me."
Yeah.
And then they were able to properly diagnose me with bipolar disorder type 1.
Yeah. And this disease, it seems as though it hit you at a later age than most people, but it seems there are these periods of euphoria, feeling like Superman, and then there are increasingly long drops into depression. Is that correct?
Yes. In my bipolar span, which really went, my onset in 2003 to when I got fired in 2014, I was probably 85, 90% of the time manic.
Yeah.
Which boosted me. And then after I got my diagnosis, I went from bad to worse. I spent 2 years in just intense depression and psychosis, which are hallucinations and delusions.
Wow.
I mean, I was really, really sick. I was barely staying alive. All I wanted to do was to die. I didn't want to live. Had convinced myself my wife would be better off without me. And so the depression is just, I called it bipolar hell.
Yeah. Wow. And that part of it you had never really experienced.
That's correct.
You had little episodes of everybody gets down once in a while, but it just seemed to grow in severity as time went on.
Yes. And that's the nature of bipolar disorder. If untreated, it's going to get worse and worse. The manic highs are going to get higher and higher. The depressive lows are going to get lower. Until you got to where I was. And I mean, if there was a very high probability of me dying during that time. A lot of doctors said, "You're lucky you didn't have a heart attack,"
yeah,
"or a stroke, or that you didn't have some sort of violent encounter with the police or somebody else, or that you didn't die by suicide."
Yeah. Wow. And luckily you had a tremendous support system around you. Your wife sounds like an amazing, amazing woman. And then 2 of your sons had gone through versions of the same illness. And so they were sort of able to help you and also to go like, "Well, I know what he's going through."
Yes. We forged kind of a unique 3-way bond with, the common illness of bipolar disorder. We had learned a lot because both of them were diagnosed with bipolar disorder before I was.
Yeah.
So both I and my wife had learned a lot about it. We just had no idea that I would be next.
Yeah.
And we didn't pick it up at all. And it was completely unknown, unrecognized, undiagnosed until the end, 2014.
Yeah.
So they've been really helpful. And, we've got a strong bond that with this common disease.
You go through this period of 2 years of depression. You have suicidal thoughts. You can't get out of bed. I mean, it just sounds horrible. And at the same time, you're seeing doctors and they don't know how to treat you. Is this correct?
They tried a lot of things that did not work.
Yeah.
So I guess you could say they didn't know how to treat it. They tried lots of medications, various doctors, the military doctors, the civilian doctors. None of them had any effect except to make me groggy and fall asleep. And then when I went to the VA, they tried some different medications. We did electroconvulsive therapy, mm-hmm. which didn't have any impact. And then it wasn't until August of 2016. So, 2 years into this thing that I went to the VA, and then we tried lithium, which is a natural compound in the earth. And the lithium made the difference. That turned the corner where it essentially my symptoms pretty much vanished within a week.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. But it took them a long time to get there. And in the meantime, you're suffering.
Yes.
It goes to show how little we really understand about bipolar disorder, even doctors who are sort of experts in the field. I guess everybody is treated somewhat differently, and different drugs work with different people and different treatments work with different people. Is this correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. There's no one size fits all. There's no cookbook solution to how to treat somebody. Is everybody's brain, the chemistry, the wiring is different.
Yeah.
And so they have, it affects them differently.
Yeah.
As soon as I started taking it, I mean, the depression went away.
Yeah.
My brain chemistry went into like a healthy balance zone.
Uh-huh.
The lithium sort of constructed a ceiling against mania so that I couldn't go up into mania, and then a floor against depression. And I've been in a really good, healthy, balanced state now for over 7 years.
That's fantastic. You mentioned in your book that now you're sort of an advocate for people with this condition. It would seem to me like you're an example of this, somebody who functioned at an extremely high level, and people didn't realize that you had this illness. I mean, you didn't even realize it until it got extremely acute. How many people do you think are living with this and not even aware of it?
I don't have a number, but I bet it's a very large number.
Mm-hmm.
The estimate is that 3-4% of the world population have bipolar disorder. But I think there's probably many, many more who have it, but have not been diagnosed, have not been treated, haven't gone in for help. So, I mean, you're talking millions and millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the ones who are not being treated, bipolar disorder is a very, very destructive disease. Left untreated, it destroys marriages, families, careers, finances, leads to addictions, homelessness, incarceration, and death.
Yeah.
So that's the bad news. The good news is if you go get help and you work with a doctor and they get the right treatment, you can live a happy, healthy, purposeful life like I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
But without treatment, I mean, I'd be dead, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and without the support system that you had, because
right.
even though it did put a tremendous strain on your own marriage, which sounded like a rock-solid marriage, your wife stuck by you, and you two of you were able to work through it. But you can imagine if somebody has that condition and their wife decides they can't deal with it anymore because they don't understand it, that person has to cope on their own, which is probably almost impossible to do.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, what a story. So now, what are you doing today in terms of your life?
So I've been on a journey of recovery for a little over 7 years. We moved to Florida for the brightness and the sunshine. But I call it a journey of recovery because it's a never-ending fight. The disease never goes away. You're never cured.
Mm-hmm.
You always have to really monitor. So I'm working hard to, keep myself healthy and on track, going in the right direction. And then, really rebuilt my life with, the people, the friends, the place we live. And then I came up with, this idea of a purpose. And, my purpose in life, my mission, and as a military guy, you always have to have a mission to focus on.
Yeah.
And so my mission is sharing my bipolar story to help stop the stigma, promote recovery, and save lives. I mean, that's what I do. And I do it by speaking, writing, and conferring.
Mm-hmm.
So, probably the most, I've published over 20 articles. They're on my website. I've probably given about 100 talks. Most of them are on my website. I recently confer with people, you know, med schools, doctors, all kinds of folks. And now since the book came out, I'm getting lots and lots of wonderful invitations to speak, to do podcasts, to go visit, do presentations, et cetera. One of the most exciting is just this week alone, three different major med schools, I did what they call grand rounds, which are a fancy word for giving a lecture. And so I've told my bipolar story to three leading medical schools, and I've done a whole bunch of others. And so, you know, the Navy's been really interested in my story, the Army. And so that's pretty much what I'm doing. And it's really like a full-time job.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And it seems to me that there's a lot more openness in all branches of the military to the idea of mental health and maintaining mental health and the strain of combat that combat puts on the people who are involved in it. Are you finding that as well?
Absolutely. If you go back to like when I first came in the Army, and then you go to 9/11, pre-9/11, and then you look now, 22 years later, the difference is enormous. The military is much more interested. There's a lot more training. There's way more resources. They understand the issues quite well. And then getting traction to make reforms and improvements is an ongoing battle. But I feel very good that the military has done a really very credible job of getting better in this field. Mm-hmm. Is it fast enough? No. Do we need to do more and get better? Yes. But I'm pretty happy with the job that's been done over the last 20 years.
One last question. Is this a disease that, if caught early, can be treated and you can kind of mitigate the longer term and more dramatic effects of it?
Yes.
How would they be able to see the warning signs in themselves?
Well, seeing the warning signs in yourself is very, very tricky.
Yeah.
Because when you're in mania, you don't think there's anything wrong.
Yeah.
You think you're the smartest person, Superman, et cetera. So when you're in a state of mania, you aren't going to think there's anything wrong.
Yeah.
It's when you fall into depression that then you'll realize, whoa, there's something wrong with me. I need help. But then when you go to the doctor, you have to bring other people into the discussion, like, you know, your spouse, family, your good friends, your work colleagues, because in a 15-minute appointment with the psychiatrist, they're not going to get the collateral information in the complete picture.
Yeah.
So the patient needs to help themselves. But then the other possibility is that somebody is displaying signs of bipolar disorder. If their family members, friends, or colleagues can say, hey, I'm seeing troubling signs, I'm concerned about you, I'm seeing the symptoms of bipolar disorder, here's what I'm seeing, and then they can persuade the person to go see the doctor, that's a good outcome.
Okay. Well, General, thank you so much for sharing your story. I know it must have taken a lot of courage to do so, but it's very important.
Psychiatrists and med schools are calling it the best book ever written on mental illness or bipolar disorder. I've got a website that's chock full of information, www.bipolargeneral.com.
General Martin's first VA psychiatrist told him, quote, bipolar disorder works for you until it doesn't. General Martin is a perfect example. He shot up the ranks of the U.S. military to the rank of Major General, then Commandant of the Army War College and President of the National Defense University. But all the time, he carried a vulnerability called bipolar disorder inside. In his case, it was activated by the stress of combat and the enormous responsibility he carried for tens of thousands of soldiers during the war in Iraq, and the mistakes made by our civilian leaders that incited an insurgency and extended our military involvement. The paradox is that what made General Martin a great military officer later metastasized and ended his career. It almost killed him as well. 25 to 50% of the 5 to 10 million people with bipolar disorder attempt suicide at least once. 8% succeed in killing themselves. Data shows that 700,000 veterans are afflicted. Bipolar disease is also very treatable with the right medication. I thank General Martin for courageously coming forward and telling his story and helping to end the stigma of bipolar disorder and for encouraging others suffering from this silent disease to get help and not lose hope. It's my great honor to name retired Major General Greg F. Martin as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.